Oh, hello. Hi. Come on in. We've been expecting you. A little hectic out here, isn't it? Come on in. In you come. Make yourself at home. The kettle's already on. Here, let me take your jacket for you. No, don't worry about it. Look, I'm just glad you've made it. Grab a seat and I'll get you some tea. Now, do you like milk or sugar in your tea? Maybe both? Ah, brave choice. There you are. Careful, it's still a little hot. So how are you? We haven't seen you in quite some time, and it's probably more our fault than yours, to be honest. Yeah. I know, the world just seems to be a little off at the moment, doesn't it? Ah well, you're here now. Where's here? Where are you? I thought that would have been obvious by now. This is an audio narrative employed to lull you into a false sense of security. This is an overture designed not to protect you from the world, but to fold back the layers of bias, conspiracy, and disinformation to reveal what's real about the world. Let the facade fade. Look around. Look at our media, our economic priorities. Look at our politics. The once open-minded left is intolerant and dogmatic. The once sensible right is capricious and incoherent. A reality TV star is the president of the United States, and we have an actual Nazi problem. So welcome. This reality is your new home. This is insanity. This is asininity. This is nonsensicality. Your passports are stamped and you're here to stay. Welcome to Absurdistan.
Hello, Absurdistanis, and welcome to the first episode of Absurdistan, the transatlantic political podcast where the absurd is the new normal. My name is John, and I'm joined by Adam. Today, we look at Trump's nominee for Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, Wednesday's announcement of a snap election in Turkey, and we also have a brief report on the federal solution to the Catalan crisis. We begin today in Turkey, where President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has announced a snap election.
Hi, John. You'll know, and we've had this conversation in the past, that one of my main concerns is the rise of authoritarianism in Europe. Now, this has happened in a couple countries, or at least the evolution seems to be happening in a couple countries, specifically in Poland and Hungary. Although in Hungary, you could perhaps color it more as democratic illiberalism, but that's just getting pedantic. Just across the European Union border from Bulgaria is Turkey, where a year ago, in fact, almost exactly to the day, on April 16th, 2017, Turks voted in a constitutional referendum that changed their, well, really the whole institution of the state. Do you remember this happening, John? I think we had a fairly long discussion on it.
I do. If I remember right, it centralized power to the presidency. Before, there was more of a strong parliament with a prime minister and more of a ceremonial position being the presidency. But then with these reforms, it concentrated power more so to the presidency and also introduced longer term limits for the president. Is that correct?
Almost, yep. It's rather fortuitous for Erdogan. But while term limits for the presidency do exist in the new constitution, time spent in the presidency before the reforms don't actually count towards those new term limits. So hooray for Erdogan, he probably gets to stay in office. Now, the reason this is important is because the reforms haven't actually taken effect yet. They only take effect after the next presidential and parliamentary elections, which were supposed to happen in November of 2019. The announcement this week from President Erdogan is that those elections will be taking place in just a couple months, on the 24th of June. Now, what this will do is implement the new reforms a full year and a half before they were supposed to.
So why the rush?
Well, it ultimately depends on who you believe. If you're listening to Erdogan, he would say that, in fact, this is a quote from his announcement just this week, "The diseases of the old system confront us at every step we take. Developments in Syria and elsewhere have made it urgent to switch to the new executive system in order to take steps for our country's future in a stronger way. Sure, possible. But as you know, Erdogan himself has been known to have authoritarian tendencies, and so you can't just read literally what he's saying as gospel truth. Turkey's economy, while still growing fast at 7.4%, is one of the fastest growing economies in the world. It's beginning to struggle, particularly with the Turkish currency, the lira. The lira took a nosedive, struggling with double-digit inflation and the government's growing deficit. Erdogan's popularity largely hinges on the prosperity that Turkey has experienced over the past number of years and the economic growth that they've experienced. Mm-hmm. Erdogan's invested millions into infrastructure, and that's largely boosted the economy. But one would say that it could be a bit of an artificial bubble, and that bubble could be on the way to bursting. So it's possible that Erdogan is trying to preempt an inevitable economic crash, getting his election in there before, you know, everything turns to rubbish.
From what I know of Erdogan, it doesn't surprise me that he would want to try to consolidate power earlier. This man has definitely always shown authoritarian tendencies. I remember that he was trying to get Germany to remove commercials that were critical of him. So he was trying to get another country to remove content on his whim, essentially, and he was quite upset about it. He seems to me to be a little thin-skinned and maybe even insecure in his own power, and if it would be harmed by an economic crash that he may see coming, it makes sense that he would want to secure his position earlier.
Yeah, of course. And he's done, you know, you mentioned Germany there, he's done the same with the Netherlands. There was almost a diplomatic incident between the Netherlands and Turkey surrounding the Dutch approach to the constitutional referendum a year ago, which I think limited the amount that Turkey could spend, in the Netherlands in particular, to promote Erdogan and his reforms. There might be another thing on his mind, though, other than the economics, and that is the rise of a new political party, a new kid on the block. I'm going to try and pronounce this, the EYİ Parti, which in English literally means the Good Party. Now, the Good Party was formed only in October last year, I feel only, 6 months ago, and 6 months after the constitutional referendum, and it was founded as a secular, conservative, nationalist, anti-Erdogan party. Now, this is actually quite a big deal that an anti-Erdogan party can exist. I've been chatting with a Turkish friend today who was saying that, well, Erdogan and his cronies tend to imprison party leaders that they disagree with. One of the party leaders currently has one of their leaders in jail just now. Does that sound familiar, anyone? Yeah. Being in Spain. So the EYİ Parti is a conservative, secular and nationalist party. And in the Turkish context, that actually means a lot. It means a lot more than what we can get into here, but know this. Turkey's political landscape is largely split religiously between the religious and the secular. Erdogan tends to ride the waves of conservative religious support. The EYİ Parti provides a secular nationalism without the religious overtones. Their leader, Meral Akşener, is a defector from an Erdogan-allied party, the nationalist MHP. After they supported Erdogan's constitutional reform, she decided to leave the party and form her own party. The EYİ Parti platform is a rollback of the constitutional reforms, and they would rather focus on judicial reforms and specifically reforming the laws that govern political parties, something that Erdogan has used to his advantage to keep himself and his ruling party in power. So she plans to run against Erdogan on the presidential ballot. Now, I tried to get an understanding of how Turkish elections work. So it's not simply that Erdogan uses a monopoly on media. If you're in Turkey, the media that you're going to see is going to be dominated by Erdogan. Additionally, he also uses techniques that actually manipulate the vote itself. He cuts electricity. There are charges that he's beaten people, that he allows people to use fake ballot papers. And so because of all these things, the competition can never be fair, can never be equal.
Again, I think that's probably because he's insecure in his own power. If you have to resort to tactics like that to win an election, that's usually a sign that you're authoritarian. I would guess, though, that the EU party would be rather successful in Turkey, because from what I understand, since the reforms of Ataturk, Turkey has actually valued secularism.
Well, right. So when you say conservatism in Turkey, you know, you could mean two things. Do you mean political conservatism or religious conservatism? Because to be politically conservative in Turkey actually means to return to secularism, something that Erdogan has been moving away from. So the original Turkish state, as founded by Ataturk, was supposed to be this secular state. But, you know, time has proven differently, and whether Erdogan himself is actually a committed religious subscriber, I'm not too sure, but he's certainly ridden the wave of support from people who do subscribe to religious conservatism.
Do you think it would be fair to say then that the EE party's appeal to the people would be their appeal to the founding values, you could say, of Turkey itself?
Yeah, definitely. But I think it'll just depend on the priorities and values that the people have. If, you know, like any fundamentalist religious person, whether it's Muslim, Christian, or otherwise, you'll place your religion before the state and you'll push your state towards that religious fundamental ideology. And so if you're, say, on the left, for instance, in Turkey, the EU party isn't who you're going to be voting for. You can't back them because they're a right-wing nationalist party as well. There's a lot of different cross sections at play in Turkish politics at the moment. Not only a balance between authoritarianism and democracy or secularism and religious, but you still have your left and right economic stuff as well. What will likely happen in the upcoming elections is that the EE party will be pulling votes away from the ruling AKP party, and that their leader, Meral Akşener, will pull away votes from Erdogan. Of course, we already know that Erdogan has a monopoly on the media and has other abilities, let's say, to change outcomes of the election. We'll have to see what happens in June. So there are two main things I'd say before finishing this out. One, there is another aspect of Erdogan's ingeniousness, let's say, in moving the election up as early as he has. Because the EU party was only founded in October, it's possible that they might not actually be allowed to run candidates in the June election. Smart move. Get rid of your opposition by excluding them altogether. And second, the Turkish election will take place under a state of emergency. Now, this is the same state of emergency that was put in place in July 16 after the coup, the military coup that tried to usurp Erdogan's power. That initial state of emergency was only supposed to last 3 months, but it's just been extended again for the seventh time by the Turkish parliament. So the state of emergency gives the Turkish government wide-ranging powers to just change stuff on a whim because, quote-unquote, national security. And so Erdogan will be able to kind of play about as he sees fit to manipulate the election. So we'll have to see what happens, and we'll have to wait till June to see what happens ultimately. But it's an interesting story.
It really is. I think we'll probably end up doing an election special when that comes around.
Yeah, titled How Erdogan Became President. Like, we essentially know the outcome. Like, it's very, very highly likely that Erdogan will be elected again. Now, obviously, the cynical part of me puts air quotes around elected. But the most likely opposition will come from this new EE party, if they are actually allowed to run on the ballot.
We'll see. Maybe we'll have a situation like we did in the UK, where Theresa May tried to consolidate power by calling a snap election and it blew up in her face.
That is possible. It is possible, and I've read this in a couple places, that some analysts think that because Erdogan has pulled the election so blatantly forward for such specific reasons that they'll end up punishing him at the ballot box. So, but again, that takes people to actually go out the house, go to the ballot box and place ballots into a box and have it counted. Like, there are so many different steps that could be interfered with. So that's probably enough from Europe just now. Why don't we head over to the United States? John, what do you have for us this week?
This week, the confirmation proceedings for Mike Pompeo, current CIA director and President Trump's nominee to replace Rex Tillerson as Secretary of State, are ongoing. This could potentially be President Trump's most controversial pick. He's had some controversial picks in the past, such as Betsy DeVos and Ben Carson. But you haven't really seen this level of public opposition coming from not only Democrats, but also some within the Republican Party as well, most notably Rand Paul. The confirmation hearing happened last week. It was a little heated at times. Generally, what happens is a committee has a hearing, they ask him a ton of questions, then they make a recommendation and allow his vote to go forward to the Senate, where then he'll be confirmed or voted down. The committee that he was in front of is the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. It's comprised of 10 Democrats and 11 Republicans. There are two Democratic members of this committee who actually voted to approve Pompeo as the CIA director in January of last year. Those are Senators Gene Shaheen and Tim Kaine. But they have come out and announced that they will not be voting for his nomination to Secretary of State. In addition, Senator Rand Paul has come out in strong opposition to Pompeo, and he has already announced that he's voting no in the committee, and also if it gets to the Senate for a vote. So if you're doing the math, assuming that the rest of the committee members vote along party lines, you would have Rand Paul being the tiebreaker, and he's already said that he'll vote no. This means that he could actually be pushed to the Senate for a vote without a recommendation. And no Secretary of State, since we've been keeping public records after 1925, has been confirmed by the Senate if he hasn't had a positive recommendation from the committee.
So what I don't really understand about Pompeo is that some of the reports I've read say that he's hawkish on foreign policy. So why would he ever be nominated and approved for the CIA directorship to begin with?
Well, that's actually the foundation of Rand Paul's opposition. What Rand Paul argues is that Pompeo is directly contradictory to the supposed values of the Trump administration. Trump ran on anti-interventionism. He ran on stopping the war in Afghanistan and Iraq, and he's been very vocal in the past about not intervening in Syria. So it seems a bit of a jump for Trump to nominate Pompeo. I agree. I think maybe what we're seeing is the influence of more hawkish elements within the administration. Recently, John Bolton came on board as the new National Security Advisor. And anybody who knows John Bolton knows that he's incredibly hawkish. He still defends the Iraq war to this day and says that it was a success. In fact, he attributes the failures in Iraq to not having a stronger presence long term there. What John Bolton has argued in the past is that in order to maintain stability in Iraq, we would need to have a full-time military presence there indefinitely. Now, Pompeo was nominated by Trump prior to John Bolton joining the administration, but both those events seem to indicate that there are elements within the administration pushing Trump towards more interventionist and hawkish policies. We've seen that even in the last 2 weeks, Trump bombed Syria again, something that he said that he really wouldn't do, something that he criticized Obama for. So there's an inconsistent message coming out of the White House when it comes to foreign policy.
What bothers me a little bit about this appointment as well, if that's true, is that the Secretary of State is supposed to be your head diplomat. And if you've got a hawkish person as your head diplomat, you know, diplomacy is supposed to be this thing where countries can get together to discuss and avoid things like war.
Right.
But instead, you've got a war hawk in office. You know, it doesn't necessarily point to... In fact, I can see the likes of Rand Paul withholding his approval for this. That makes sense.
Absolutely. Rand Paul's always been anti-interventionist. Him and his father have always been libertarians, and they've always taken a strong stance against interventionist wars. They were against the preemptive actions in Iraq and Afghanistan. They're against escalation with North Korea, and they're against any involvement in Syria and Iran. So it makes sense for Rand Paul to come out in opposition here. He's not acting against his principles. This is actually something I probably expected from Rand Paul. I respect Rand Paul a lot, actually, as a member of the Senate, though I don't always agree with him. He always votes with his principles. He does not compromise, which is not necessarily something that we've come to expect from members of Congress. Regardless of whether or not Pompeo matches the message that's been coming out of the White House regarding anti-interventionist policies, there's been a huge push from the White House to get him confirmed lately. President Trump revealed on Twitter that Pompeo had already met in secret with North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un, which is, as far as I know, unprecedented. A nominee for Secretary of State had a one-on-one meeting with another world leader. According to Pompeo, that meeting went well. He said that it established a good line of communication between him and Kim Jong-un. Now, if you've been paying attention, Trump has been talking about potentially meeting face-to-face with Kim Jong-un and discussing denuclearization. And right now, Trump is really pushing to get his Secretary of State confirmed so that he can have somebody who already has spoken with Kim Jong-un and already has an understanding of what he wants out of the negotiation to be by his side. So Trump is putting some extra pressure to keep Republicans in line. And what we've seen so far in this administration is that when it comes to these sort of confirmations, the votes are almost always split down party lines. Now, you have some defectors from the Democrats, notably Jeanne Shaheen and Joe Manchin, who are two red state Democrats. They tend to be more conservative.
Which I was very surprised at, because Jeanne Shaheen is the New Hampshire state senator. And I wouldn't have called New Hampshire a red state.
New Hampshire voted for Trump. It was a very close margin, but there is a high level of support for Trump in New Hampshire. People from New Hampshire almost expect the Republicans to go along with Trump's agenda. So there is extra pressure on people like Tim Kaine, people like Jeanne Shaheen, people like Joe Manchin to vote for Mike Pompeo and to advance Trump's agenda, especially with the midterms coming up and them having challengers from the Republican Party. They don't want to be voted out of office in favor of someone else who would be more likely to go along with Trump's agenda, something that these red states almost are expecting their elected representatives to do. Between the pressure that many Democrats are getting from their constituents and the pressure that's being put on by Trump by making this announcement, if his announcement was on purpose, I really think it's a brilliant political move.
It's ingenious.
What's happening is that the White House is essentially daring Democrats to vote against the nomination. If Trump attends the meeting without Pompeo and the meeting goes south, he will have a scapegoat in anyone who didn't vote to confirm him. And if he goes and the meeting goes incredibly well and he gets Kim Jong-un to agree to denuclearization, then he'll be able to say that he was successful in spite of the Democrats. So either way in this situation, Trump can control the narrative now.
Remember, I think it was a year ago when... It was when Trump was inaugurated. I think I mentioned to you that Trump would be the president that would bring peace to North Korea.
No, I do remember you saying that, and I was skeptical at the time. I'm still skeptical just because of Mike Pompeo's hawkish tendencies. I think it's naive to think that somebody like Kim Jong-un is going to voluntarily denuclearize. I don't think that's going to happen. And if that's the standard for the talks that are had, I don't think that they're going to be successful. I view Kim Jong-un, even though he is a dictator and obviously terrible to his own people, I view him as a rational actor. He wants to stay in power. He's not going to do something that threatens his hold on power. He has a very successful propaganda machine over there. And he also, I'm sure, has a knowledge of other international events. Remember back in 2003, Muammar Gaddafi gave up his nuclear program voluntarily. And then not even 15 years later, he was toppled by the West. I think Kim Jong-un looks at that and he understands that his military on its own could not stand up against an assault from South Korea even, and definitely not the United States. The only card that Kim Jong-un really has in this negotiation is the potential use of nuclear weapons. And so I don't think that he's ever going to give that up. Mike Pompeo has also come out in the past in support of regime change in North Korea. He's always been in support of regime change in Iran. He supported regime change in Iraq, and that doesn't look like it's going to change.
Do you think Pompeo is more of a lapdog for Trump? Because Tillerson had a tendency to, I don't want to say contradict Trump, but Tillerson often had a tendency to have ideas slightly different from the White House. And then both sides would often contradict each other. You would often get mixed messages, one coming at the White House and one coming at the State Department.
No, that's definitely a factor. Trump has come out and said that Pompeo is somebody that he really gets along well with, and that there were things that him and Tillerson just couldn't agree on. If you'll remember, not even a couple months ago, Trump was using Twitter to literally threaten North Korea. And that rhetoric was extreme. But then Rex Tillerson was almost the counterbalance to that rhetoric, focusing more on diplomacy. And I think that you're not going to see that as much with Mike Pompeo. I don't think that he values diplomacy as much as he values preemptive action.
And this is your head diplomat.
This is the head diplomat. And he has actually advocated before for preemptive strikes of North Korea.
So it looks as if this committee won't assent to his nomination, but send it to the Senate anyway. Obviously, the Senate is split. Is it 52-48 or is it 51-49 now? I'm not sure. In other words, it's very close.
It's 51-49 because there was a special election in which a Democrat won. But you also have to remember that Senator John McCain is absent now because he's dealing with cancer. And then we also have Rand Paul, who has said openly that he's not going to vote yes. Not many senators have come out and revealed exactly how they would vote. We've seen in the past, even for very controversial nominees like Betsy DeVos, for instance, where it was very much split along party lines. And that's really what I'm expecting this time. You've seen such a split that many of these have had to been broken by Mike Pence as the tiebreaker. The only Republican that I know of that is switching sides is Rand Paul. They may try to flip a Democrat, to be honest. They might try to flip a red state Democrat who leans more conservatively like Joe Manchin. If Joe Manchin does flip his vote, you would have 50 votes for the lone Democrat and 49 Republicans. Then you'd have 49 votes against, where you have 48 Democrats and Rand Paul from the Republican Party. So in either case, it's going to be an incredibly close vote.
Are there any likelihoods that any of the retiring senators, Jeff Flake, for instance, might cast a dissenting vote?
There is a possibility. I haven't seen anything that Jeff Flake has said about this, but he has come out in opposition to the Trump White House before, and he might do it just as a statement. I haven't seen anything where he's revealed what his vote's going to be. So either way, it's going to be very, very close.
Do we know when the vote in the Senate will take place, if it were to take place?
Well, Senator Bob Corker has come out and said that he'd like to force a vote as early as next week. So we could see that happen fairly quickly. We'll keep you updated on that. I did want to discuss one other thing with this, though. Although the political machinations that are going on behind the scenes here in his nomination process are very interesting, his nomination could have profound effects on foreign policy. Obviously, we've already mentioned that he tends to be hawkish, so we could see an increased presence in the Middle East, in Syria, for instance. We could see stronger action on Iran. He has always not supported the Iran nuclear deal. During his confirmation, he wouldn't commit to whether or not he would recertify the deal as Secretary of State, even though he was asked multiple times, he wouldn't settle on an answer. So that is an open question, what he would do with the Iran nuclear deal. In his hearing, he did admit that there was no evidence that Iran has violated the deal, but he still wouldn't commit to extending it, which in the eyes of the international community is a bad thing. The Iran nuclear deal is fairly popular with other world leaders. And when Trump first started going soft on the deal and indicating that they might pull out, it caused a bit of a panic in worldwide leaders, because although the deal is not perfect, it was a fairly groundbreaking deal with Iran, something that we've never had before. So you could see a stronger stance coming from the State Department should Pompeo be confirmed. And that could potentially have far-reaching consequences in foreign policy and world politics, really, if he does indeed turn out to be as hawkish as we think he will on countries like Syria, Iraq, Iran, and North Korea. Many of our listeners will know that the Catalan region of Spain has been in tumult recently over a vote to declare independence. In this special report, Adam takes a look at the current climate in Catalonia and potential resolutions to the growing independence movement.
This is Paral·lel, one of the main arterial roads in Barcelona's city centre. And for the past 7 months, it's been my home. It's a busy road, lots of traffic, vehicular and otherwise. Lots of bustle, skateboarders, tourists, kids playing. This is Paral·lel on your average sunny weekday afternoon. This, however, was Paral·lel on Sunday. More than 300,000 people gathered on this street to mark 6 months since the arrest and imprisonment of Jordi Cuixart and Jordi Sanchez, presidents of two non-political but pro-independence organisations. They came together to demand the release of political prisoners, Catalan leaders held by Spain, and the return of others currently in self-imposed exile in other European countries. The modern manifestation of Catalonia's independence movement began in earnest in 2010, after the Spanish Supreme Court declared a rewrite of Catalonia's Statute of Autonomy unconstitutional. The Statute of Autonomy is the law that establishes the political institutions of Catalonia and their competencies. The rewrite was agreed to by the Spanish and Catalan parliaments and was backed by Catalans in a referendum, and it would have handed significant financial and cultural powers to the region. Instead, most of it was rewritten by the Spanish judiciary and its interpretation was heavily restricted. And since then, calls for independence have been growing, and along with it, the Spanish state's deafness and obstinacy. The rest of the story you should be fairly familiar with. Mass protests, advisory referenda, and the now infamous October 1st referendum. But now, there is stasis. Catalonia now inhabits an awkward space between two unobtainable ends. On one hand, the illegal referendum and Spain's brutal reaction to it has iced relationships between the two governments. And Catalan reconciliation with Spain and an amicable return to the fold is highly unlikely. Catalan has just simply come too far. On the other hand, the independence movement has stalled out. Only 43% voted in the October 1st referendum, and only 92% of those supported separation. At the time, many pro-independence supporters argued that Spain's tactic of intimidation had worked, and lowered the number of people who were willing to brave the line of policemen in riot gear. But in the subsequent regional elections held in December, pro-independence parties won only 48% of the vote. Support for independence, it seems, has peaked below 50%. So what now for Catalonia? How does it manoeuvre out of this weird limbo between returning back to Spain and heading towards illegitimate independence? Some still look to the European Union as the saving grace, but the EU will always prioritise the interest of its members. Others argue that the harder the Spanish state fights independence via unjust means, the more likely it is that those in the fence will support independence. Well, this is certainly possible, I find it personally unlikely. Looking at Scotland, where even after the UK choosing Brexit, well, Scotland voted 62% to remain in the European Union, support for independence is at best unchanged, if not slipping. And finally, there's never really a guarantee that those 60+% in Catalonia who feel at least somewhat Spanish would ever want to fully give up their Spanish identity, no matter the political situation. Identity sometimes trumps politics. So here, we're going to be looking at one of the solutions that's been floating around to solve the crisis. Reforming the Spanish state into a federation. Now, Spanish federation works if two assumptions are true. One, federalism is a viable answer to the problem of national pluralism within the state. And two, Spain is actually willing to sacrifice and reform for the sake of unity. Federalism is sharing sovereignty over two or more levels of government. Political units come together to form a pact of political unity which grants certain powers to a central or federal government while retaining some autonomy for its constituent political parts. Now, those of you listening in the United States, you'll find this quite boring. This is a reminder of your fourth grade history classes. In 1789, the American states signed a federal pact, i.e. the Constitution, which formed a federal government with significant powers while retaining myriad powers for themselves. You'll know that fairly well. Your country was founded with the federal structure ingrained in its DNA. Most of Europe doesn't share your political genes, as most of our countries trace their history back into the heavily centralised absolute monarchies of the 19th century and the heavily centralised dictatorships of the 20th century. Other than in Switzerland, federalism has been introduced in Europe in very specific contexts for very specific purposes. In Germany and Austria, it was introduced by the Allied occupation powers to ensure that former Nazi territory would never be able to unite under a strong centralised government. In Bosnia and Herzegovina, federalism was introduced to stop violence by giving warring communities political shared power within the state. And in Belgium, it was introduced to keep a plurinational state together. Does that sound familiar? Home to the Dutch-speaking Flemish community, the French-speaking Walloon community, and a small German-speaking community, Belgium was founded as a unitary, heavily centralised state in 1830. As inter-community tensions began to block effective governance in the mid-20th century, the Belgian government initiated the first of six state reforms which implemented a federal structure, granting significant powers to its cultural communities while keeping them unified under a central government. The communities now have control over health, education, language and cultural policies, agriculture, fisheries, local and provincial government, foreign trade, and rules governing political parties, as well as significant economic powers and tax powers. All national communities now have the freedom to form policy across an array of competencies, all while benefiting from shared defence, intelligence, foreign diplomacy, a shared economy, and a shared justice system. And Belgium still exists. Even after some political crises around 2010 threatened the unity of the country pulled through, the communities pulled together. Federalism provided the platform for the two communities to pull together and restored good governance after years of political roadblocks and inter-community tension. So, can Spain learn from Belgium's example? Belgium, unlike Spain, benefits from a largely symmetrical makeup. There are three language communities and three federal subunits. Spain, on the other hand, has 32 autonomous communities. What happens when only a couple of them claim a right to national self-determination? It appears that if federalism is to be the solution, then Spain has two options. The first is multinational federalism, and the second is territorial federalism. Multinational federalism is exactly what it sounds like. The multiple nations within Spain would get together and pact a new federal agreement, a new constitution. It would mirror the Belgian solution. Three national communities, three equal federal subunits. The Spanish, Catalan and Basque communities would come together to pact a federal agreement which would see significant devolutions of power to the communities while maintaining a shared central government for defence, trade and foreign relations. But this would require total constitutional reform, which under the current constitution, in Article 168, requires two-thirds majorities in both houses of the Spanish Parliament, the Cortes. After that, an immediate dissolution of the Cortes and an election, followed by another two-thirds majority in both houses of the newly elected Cortes, and then a nationwide popular referendum. It's not an easy process. Territorial federalism would be easier, as all that would be required is a change in the powers exercised by the current autonomous communities. Territorial federalism would mirror Canada's answer to the Quebec crisis. In order to assuage otherwise pro-independence Quebecois, Canada introduced wholesale devolution of power from the central government to all the provinces, not just Quebec. Quebec received new powers that it had been seeking for a while all the other provinces were handed new powers that they didn't ask for and in some cases didn't want. Accomplishing this in Spain requires only constitutional amendment, not constitutional reform, and so that falls under Article 167, which requires the relatively easy three-fifths majority in both houses of the Cortes. So the legal ability to change the Spanish constitution and its political makeup is there. All that's required is the will of the Spanish people. But, as in other parts of Europe, Spain is experiencing an upsurge in Spanish nationalism. Though, unlike in other parts of Europe, it isn't expressing itself in a far-right neo-fascist party. Instead, Spanish nationalism is one of the core principles of two of the most popular parties in Spain, the Partido Popular, which is the People's Party in English, and Ciudadanos, citizens. And combined, currently, both of them are polling around 50%. Between the two of them, they would easily sweep up the majority of seats in the Cortes. As with most nationalisms, one of the foundational beliefs of Spanish nationalism is the integrity of Spanish sovereign territory. In the mind of the Spanish people, federalism could be just that one first step down the slippery slope to national disintegration.
Finally today, we take a look at some developing stories that you should pay attention to this week.
Well, I'm not sure if you should pay attention to this first one, but this week on the 24th, on Tuesday, Greenland will be having their general election. Now, this is kind of one of those things that real political buffs really like. Greenland is one of these interesting countries that actually has an independence movement similar to Scotland and Catalonia and other places. And it is actually often the case that the pro-independence parties win. Now, the long-term outlook for Greenland is independence in 50 years, but it's really interesting to see the development of the argument as they go along. This time round, there's a new party, the the cooperation party, which advocates closer cooperation with Denmark. Now, there are other unionist parties, but this one specifically argues for increased immigration and assimilation of migrants into Greenlandic culture. Now, Greenlanders are Inuit, essentially. They are Eskimos. It's a Native American culture. And so for foreigners to assimilate into it, especially given the population is only about 50,000, can be rather controversial. It's just an interesting look at another culture that's completely different from our own. It's worth a look.
Also worth paying attention to this week in the United States, you may have noticed that several teachers' unions in many different states have been on strike recently, most notably Oklahoma, where they were very successful. They had a 9-day walkout, which resulted in the government giving $479 million to up teachers' pay by an average of $6,100. This is the largest pay raise in state history. They also were able to get pay raises for supporting staff like bus drivers and cafeteria workers, and they got $70 million in recurring revenue for classroom supplies, which is a big deal. I have several friends who are teachers in the States, and they routinely talk about having to pay for their own classroom supplies because things are so poorly funded. Even in Massachusetts, that's the state I live in, where our investment in public education is rather high relative to other states. So you can imagine in states like Oklahoma with smaller education budgets, such a large raise is a big deal. Well, on the coattails of that success that we've seen from Oklahoma, Arizona teachers are now voting this week whether or not they should stage a walkout. And so we're seeing almost a domino effect of states one by one having these actions. This happened in Tennessee, Oklahoma, I believe Virginia as well. Now, if Arizona does, we might see many more of these walkouts in the future that, in my opinion, are good for our teachers' unions and good for our public education in the States.
Jumping back to Europe, don't forget to check out the upcoming Irish referendum on abortion. Now, this is actually 5 weeks away, but the campaigning for the referendum itself is already up and running. The Eighth Amendment to the Irish Constitution, that's right, it was a constitutional amendment, forbid abortion. And so there are two campaigns, Save the Eighth and Repeal the Eighth. Now, like I said, it's 5 weeks away, but it's a divisive issue in Ireland. Irish society as a whole is probably best described by waning social conservatism. Ireland did vote to legalise gay marriage not too long ago, and that was by referendum. It was the first in the world to do so. For this abortion debate, it's another social issue that's going to public referendum. So whether you're on the pro-life side of the debate or the pro-choice side of the debate, this is worth a look in. This is cultural change happening democratically and on the ground.
Sticking with Europe, well, kind of, we have the potential for a trade dispute between the EU and the United States. Listeners probably know about the tariff escalations that are currently going on between China and the United States. But there's a flashpoint coming on May 1st between the EU and the United States when it comes to trade. There is a reprieve from steel and aluminum tariffs that the EU currently enjoys, and that expires on May 1st. The EU wants the exemption to be permanent, but the United States wants concessions when it comes to this. The EU Trade Commissioner Cecilia Malmström and the U.S. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross have met 3 times already via teleconference. But no headway has been made on this issue. The Trump administration has always been strongly against trade deficits, which we currently operate at with the EU. And so you can expect a hard line from the United States, who definitely is in a better position than the EU when it comes to this. I think the EU probably needs the United States more than the United States needs the EU in this sense. So you could potentially get another trade dispute, this time across the Atlantic Ocean.
Yay! To stay within the European Union, and actually specifically the Eurozone, Emmanuel Macron, the shining star of France, is visiting his counterpart Angela Merkel in Germany this week. One of Emmanuel Macron's proposed changes to the European Union while he was campaigning for the presidency was to bring in a Eurozone finance minister. Now, this has essentially gone by the wayside because Angela Merkel is the leader of the Conservative Party in Germany, and her backbenchers have a tendency to be rather conservative financially. They have a tendency essentially not to want to see German money heading towards the rather economically lackluster southern European countries. They would prefer that German money stays in Germany. To add to that, Angela Merkel, particularly the conservative wing of her party, are also being squeezed out by the AfD, the Alternative for Deutschland party. Now, this is a right-wing party that tends to be a little bit more Eurosceptic and tends to be more pro-German. So, Emmanuel Macron is heading into quite a difficult meeting in which a lot of his campaign promises, particularly regarding the Eurozone, which I think now include a reform of banking laws and beefing up bankruptcy relief for European countries, all of these things are going to go by the wayside. Well, maybe. You'll need to check it out, because we don't know the answer. You will. That's worth checking out.
And finally today, if you're interested at all in the ongoing Russia investigation being conducted by Robert Mueller, you want to know that the Senate might be voting on legislation to protect Mueller from being fired by President Trump. There have been rumblings that President Trump has wanted to fire Mueller for a while, and it's not unprecedented considering he did fire James Comey last year. Up until now, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has refused to allow this to go to a vote because he doesn't really find any evidence that Mueller is in any danger of being fired. However, Senator Tom Tillis is currently writing legislation to protect Mueller, and he has announced that him and some other Republicans may go forward with pushing through this bill for a vote, even if McConnell does not support it. The argument being one of principle, where although they do support the president, they also support the democratic rule of law and the institution of due process through the court system. So that's something to keep an eye on, whichever side you fall on the Russia investigation. That could be coming as early as this week. And that's all for this episode. Thank you for listening. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Absurdistanis. We're also on YouTube as Absurdistan with an exclamation point. Be sure to check out our website, absurdistanis.com. That's absurdistanis.com. We post all episodes to this website and also host forums for discussion so that you as the audience can engage with our content. Thanks for listening, and as always, stay weird.